November 16th, this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump is still refusing to concede to Joe Biden, inflaming supporters and delaying the transition.
If the Republican voters are only hearing Donald Trump's misrepresentation, it's not surprising that they believe it.
Health officials warn of a dire situation with the COVID-19 pandemic in the coming months.
The United States is in a heap of trouble. We've got not just COVID cases, but also hospitalizations and deaths rising at an unprecedented rate.
Also ahead, a successful blast off to the International Space Station. It's all on today's International Edition. The transition to President-elect Joe Biden's administration remained in political limbo Sunday, a day after tens of thousands of President Donald Trump's supporters poured into the nation's capital over the weekend to echo his unsubstantiated claims of election fraud. Biden has spent days huddled with advisors as he puts his team together and maps out the policies he'll pursue after being sworn in on January 20th. Meanwhile, it appeared at a time on Sunday that Trump was acknowledging for the first time that Biden had won. But as AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports, that was not the case.
Trump did not use Biden's name, but says he won, at the same time making clear he's not conceding and will keep trying to overturn the election result. The Sunday morning tweets included several baseless claims about the November 3rd vote, calling it rigged and only a victory for Biden in the eyes of the media. However, state and federal officials say the election was safe and secure. On ABC's This Week, Trump's former national security advisor John Bolton called on Republicans to speak up.
If the Republican voters are only hearing Donald Trump's misrepresentations, it's not surprising that they believe it. It's critical for other Republican leaders to stand up and explain what actually happened.
Ben Thomas, Washington.
President Trump's decision to fight the election results has left Washington lawmakers divided, with many Republicans backing a legal inquiry into Trump's allegations of voter fraud, even as they celebrate other congressional lawmakers who won their races. The U.S. election won't be officially certified for weeks. So far, the Trump administration has not provided evidence for any fraud that could overturn the result, but there is still time for more legal challenges. Joining us now for more on the president's legal options is UC Hastings constitutional law professor Joel Paul. The president continues to maintain that the election was stolen from him and has been shot down by a number of lawsuits. It seems like his options are starting to shrink, but he's still waiting for some counts, and he's been making claims about some voting machines. What sorts of legal options does President Trump have at this point in the game?
He has very few legal options available to him at this point. Something really extraordinary would have to happen. Most of the states will be certifying their election results in the next few weeks. In particular, Pennsylvania and Michigan will be certifying their election results next week. And once the election results are certified, it becomes much more difficult for the president at that point to try to challenge the electors that have been chosen. There is one very narrow possibility, and that is that in the state of Michigan, there is a panel of two Democrats and two Republicans who formally certify the results to the governor of Michigan. It is conceivable that if they don't have a majority to certify the results of the election in Michigan, it would then go to a court in Michigan to decide who won the election there. But even in that event, even if the Michigan electors were not certified, Biden has just enough electoral votes already to win with 290 left in the absence of the 16 votes that belong to Michigan. So it's hard to see how that will matter. Once the votes are certified in the states, the electors are chosen, and December 8th is the safe harbor date by which the electors have been chosen. By that date, they're presumptively valid and can't be challenged in Congress.
So even after that point, when the votes are certified and Joe Biden is not just the projected winner, but there's really no disputing that at that point, if the president continues to make very public claims that the election was rigged, it was stolen from him. How dangerous a precedent is that in this country as far as free and fair elections, which are pretty much at the foundation of democracy?
Well, the president clearly is threatening the legitimacy of the Biden administration and really threatening the democracy in our country in ways that I think undermine the United States, not just domestically, but more importantly, internationally, in the eyes of the world. We look quite foolish. And I find it remarkable the number of people who seem to accept the president's allegations in the absence of any evidence. There's no evidence here to support the president's claims. And what he's doing is undermining the legitimacy of our democracy.
We have heard that the Biden team is looking at its own legal options if the president continues stalling and refusing to cooperate with the peaceful transition of power and provide the support, the information, and the funding that the Biden team needs. What legal options might they have?
Biden could ask a court for an order directing the head of the General Services Administration to turn over office space to the Biden transition team. And a determination by a court that Biden was entitled to that office space would, in effect, be a determination that Biden was, in fact, the winner of the election. There's a very strong precedent for that. It's Marbury versus Madison. Insofar as Marbury versus Madison was a case in which the issue was whether or not a court could issue an order directing the executive branch to turn over, in that case, a commission to someone who'd been appointed a justice of the peace in the District of Columbia. In a sense, that's the same issue in this case, as to whether or not a court has the authority to order the executive branch to acknowledge who won the election. I'm surprised that the Biden's attorneys have not already undertaken such an effort. I think that it would be successful, and it would be one way of delegitimating the false claims the president continues to make about the election being rigged.
UC Hastings constitutional law professor Joel Paul, thank you for being with us. Crowds of supporters of President Trump marched through the streets of the nation's capital Saturday to protest the election results, a demonstration that eventually led to clashes. VOA's Mike O'Sullivan has the story.
They converged on the nation's capital, getting a thumbs up from President Donald Trump, who drove by in his motorcade. Despite an absence of evidence, a Trump supporter says that President-elect Joe Biden stole the election.
We hope that the nation will heal by listening to our voice so that we know that we will have a fair election. All the legitimate and fair votes and legal votes will be counted.
The far-right self-described Western chauvinists, Proud Boys, were among the protesters. So were groups billed as Women for America First, Million MAGA March, and Stop the Steal DC. There was name-calling as Biden supporters confronted the demonstrators and some skirmishes and arrests, but the march and a rally at the U.S. Supreme Court were mostly peaceful. Encouraged by President Trump, many protesters believe the election results were altered with fraudulent ballots or rigged voting machines, says Trump supporter Marita Meza.
And they can turn automatically your votes. This is why they had to recount one by one.
A close count in Georgia triggered an automatic recount, which is being done by hand. Protester Cole Ryan.
If there's one vote that is fraudulent, that's enough for me. This isn't a research project. I'm not looking for statistically significant stuff. I'm looking for one evidence of voter fraud.
But that won't make a difference, say election experts. Most analysts say recounts and legal challenges in individual states are unlikely to change the result of the election. Trump supporter Donna Cagle hasn't given up.
We hope Trump wins, but if he doesn't, the world will go on.
Protester Helen Ray Heller says it's not over yet, and Trump insists he has no plan to concede.
If President Trump concedes, then of course we're going to accept that too.
With or without a concession, President-elect Biden will take office on January 20th. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Could a new U.S. president mean fresh relations between Middle Eastern countries and the U.S.? Some citizens say change may bring hope to the region. Others say the change might not be good. But almost everyone VOA spoke to adds that after decades of frustration with U.S. policy, they are rooting for new policies in America, not individual leaders. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Istanbul.
Christopher Ibrahim, 32, is a jazz musician in Beirut, Lebanon. His mother is Armenian from Syria, and his father is Palestinian. He spent his childhood in New Jersey, in the United States. Ibrahim was happy with the results of the U.S. elections. He voted for Biden, mostly because Trump has support from white supremacist groups. He thinks Biden is the right choice for America. But, he says, maybe not for the Middle East.
So ironically, I think that Trump's policies in the long run would somehow be better because they were sort of forcing everybody to take steps, whatever those steps may be, forcing everybody to take some steps towards each other.
Ibrahim is referring to the normalization of relations between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, Sudan, and Bahrain, an achievement heralded by some and blasted by others. No one disputes, however, that this was a significant change in a situation that has been deadlocked for decades. In Sana'a, Yemen, VOA spoke to a 47-year-old English teacher named Mohamed Salah, who didn't want his voice recorded. He was surprised by the election results, but hopeful. Yemen has become the world's worst humanitarian crisis over the past few years. Millions of people are starving, and more than 100,000 are dead from a war in which the U.S. has supported Saudi Arabian-led airstrikes on Yemen for years. Could a new U.S. president stop the war, allowing more international aid to come in? Salah doesn't know for sure, but he hopes so. In Cairo, Abdul al-Masri, a 59-year-old sculptor and father of six, says he is pretty sure that it doesn't matter to Egyptians who is the U.S. president. U.S. relations in the Middle East are strictly transactional, he says. And for decades, the U.S. has been conducting wars in the region for oil profits. His statements may be disputable, but no one disputes that his belief is widely held in the Middle East. In a crowded outdoor cafe in Erbil, the capital of the Kurdistan region of Iraq, 50-year-old Ali Alwani brings up another point, one also held by everyone else we spoke to. For people in the Middle East, specific U.S. policies are important, not personalities. Alwani says the U.S. has backed the Kurds many times in past decades, but it has also left them woefully stranded in the face of deadly assaults. He doesn't care who is president, but he says U.S. policy can impact every corner of the world, and he hopes his corner will come out for the better. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Istanbul.
When President-elect Joe Biden is sworn in on January 20th, if projections hold, he will be facing the likelihood of even more coronavirus deaths and hospitalizations as cases surge across the country. The U.S. has recorded more than 10.8 million confirmed COVID-19 cases and over 245,000 deaths. AP correspondent Shelley Adler reports.
We really are in a critical situation.
Assistant Health and Human Services Secretary Admiral Brett Giroir, after a record 180,000 new COVID-19 cases were reported Saturday.
You must physically distance. When you cannot physically distance, everybody needs to wear a mask in public spaces. That's absolutely critically important. They do work.
Joining Giroir on ABC's This Week, Dr. Atul Gawande, a Harvard surgeon who was on President-elect Joe Biden's COVID-19 advisory board.
Opposing masks is like opposing washing hands. It's not political. We can pull together. We can do this.
I'm Shelley Adler.
Coronavirus cases are also surging in many countries across Europe as more nations there warn citizens to brace for months of severe restrictions to halt the rise of infections.
There's been a lot of activity with French efforts to subdue militants in Sahel, including the elimination of the top military leader of Al-Qaeda's North Africa operations. Joining us for more is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, what can you tell us?
Early last week, French forces in the Sahel neutralized the operational head of GSIM. That's an anti-insurgent jihadist group, the group to support Islam and Muslims. It's Al-Qaeda affiliated, had a lot of connections really among the local communities, particularly in central Mali. The actual person who was neutralized was no longer operational on the ground, but he was training new recruits. And so that was where his power was, to be able to get new recruits in. Then we had later in the week, French forces apparently targeted 30 jihadists again in central Mali. So this comes at a time when there has been this increase in jihadist violence. There's been this whole idea that it seemed to have been slipping away from the French, the whole operation. So for them to have this second, what they're known as big fish, was important to them, because let's not forget, back in June, they neutralized the leader of Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. And that was, again, a symbolic move, because it was the leader of that particular branch of the organization.
There's been a lot of consternation between Bamako and Paris regarding how to deal with these insurgencies, with France really digging in as far as their unwillingness to negotiate with these militants.
Indeed, Paris and Bamako are really very far apart on the issue of dialogue. Paris says, only speak with groups who have agreed to renounce violence and who are working towards some sort of national unity. For their part, in Bamako, they've had these national conciliation conferences. They've got these accords from 2017 and 2019 that supports dialogue. So they say they do need to have a dialogue. And what really upset the French was in October, when the then transition government agreed to free 200 prisoners, 200 convicted jihadists, to release them in exchange for the former Mali prime minister to be released and a French aid worker. And that was then followed by film on social media of these 200 jihadists being welcomed back into the group, welcomed back into their armed groups, again as fighters. So there is a lot of tension between Paris and Bamako at the moment. And it's difficult to see how in the short term, with the government and the regime that is in place in Mali, how this can be solved.
So what happens next as far as France's role there? What are you hearing from President Emmanuel Macron?
Emmanuel Macron will sometime in December review troop numbers in the Sahel. They are hoping to be able to withdraw a few forces and hoping that they will be replaced by other European forces, such as from Estonia or the Czech Republic. Let's not forget, it was just in January of this year that there was the big five Sahel leaders met in southwestern France, met with Emmanuel Macron, and they gave their undertaking that they supported completely what the French were doing in the Sahel. Now, since then, everything's changed a bit. Back in January, the focus was on the Islamic State and the Greater Sahel. That was really the danger. It's changed since then, and there are other groups who have come up. So there is this feeling that perhaps the French might try and pull out a few troops, because at the moment, yes, they have had these successes in the last couple of months, but they're still being... A lot of troops have been lost. France has lost 50 troops since they moved into Mali in 2013. Plus, there's a lot of pressure here in France for French troops to withdraw and to be doing more of their duty here in France, where they are needed to patrol specific sites, really sensitive sites in the country, at a time when the country itself is on a security alert.
Paris-based reporter Catherine Field, thank you so much.
The UN Human Rights Office says the government of Belarus continues to commit human rights violations with impunity against peaceful protesters 3 months after the country's disputed presidential elections. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Belarusian citizens remain outraged at the outcome of the August 9th presidential election that returned Alexander Lukashenko to power in an election widely seen as fraudulent. They continue to voice their grievances by taking to the streets in protest. UN Human Rights spokesman Rupert Colville says the government has responded to these peaceful demonstrations in a heavy-handed manner, with the use of unnecessary or excessive force by law enforcement officials.
Arbitrary mass detentions continue.
To date, it is estimated more than 25,000 people have been detained, including more than 1,000 who took part in solidarity protests in the capital, Minsk, and throughout Belarus on the 8th of November. Many of those detained have faced administrative charges, in some cases being held for up to 15 days. But the Belarusian authorities are increasingly bringing criminal charges against people.
Colville says at least 127 students taking part in demonstrations have been expelled from their courses. He says dozens of medical workers and doctors in solidarity with the opposition have been detained. He says the government reportedly has frozen the bank accounts of a charity assisting some 60 alleged victims of violence and torture. On Thursday, a 31-year-old man, Roman Bondarenko, reportedly died after he allegedly was assaulted by masked men and ill-treated by a member of the security forces. Belarusian officials have denied any role in the death. If the allegations are proven to be true, Colville says Bondarenko's death takes government abuse to a whole new level.
The latest statement from the investigative committee, that's an investigative body in Belarus, continues to indicate that the authorities for now do not acknowledge that those who attacked Mr. Bondarenko were police officers or otherwise associated with the security apparatus.
The UN Human Rights Office is calling on the Belarusian authorities to conduct a thorough independent investigation into this incident and to publicly share its results. It says the perpetrator should be brought to justice if a crime was found to have been committed. President Lukashenko, meanwhile, denies that the election was fraudulent and refuses to step down. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
We are always glad to have our listeners throughout Africa tuning in to our newscast covering Africa news. Tune in on the top of each hour 24/7. VOA is your trusted source of news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues. SpaceX launched four astronauts to the International Space Station on Sunday, on the first full-fledged taxi flight for NASA by a private company. The Falcon rocket thundered into the night from Kennedy Space Center with three Americans and one Japanese, the second crew to be launched by SpaceX. The Dragon capsule on top, named Resilience by its crew in light of this year's many challenges, most notably COVID-19, reached orbit 9 minutes later. At a news conference Friday, NASA Commercial Crew Program Manager Steve Stitch said history will be made on this mission.
That Crew One is going to be the longest U.S. space flight ever, exceeding what we had on the final Skylab mission, Skylab 3.
It's expected to reach the space station later today and remain there until spring. And with Twitter and Facebook blocking and labeling more social media posts, some American conservatives are flocking to alternatives like Parler, which says it won't censor speech. Matt Dibble reports.
It's a frustrating time for many Americans wanting to share thoughts online about the recent election. Twitter and Facebook have slapped warnings on some messages, and in a few cases, blocked postings that make false claims about the election process and the results. Now they are finding other places to go online. One of them is Parler, which promises it won't censor anything. It is now the most downloaded app on the Apple iTunes Store, and popular with supporters of President Donald Trump. Amy Peacock is chief policy officer for Parler.
We have gained well over 4 million new accounts in the last several days, maybe five. I'm losing track.
The rise of Parler comes with Americans divided over whether they want social media firms to do more to keep their sites free from misinformation and calls for violence, Or should the internet be a place for all speech? Enter Parler, from the French word parler, to speak. Prominent conservatives have flocked to the Nevada-based platform, and some are calling for people to leave Twitter and Facebook for Parler. Amy Peacock.
I think there's a lack of trust, and when they hear that there is somebody out there who says we are an unbiased, neutral, free speech platform, they're willing to at least give it a shot at a certain point.
Much of the conversation on Parler echoes President Donald Trump's unsupported claim that the November 3rd election was stolen by Democrats through massive voter fraud. There are calls for action. Demonstrations are being planned. Sometimes users cross the line. An Arkansas police chief used Parler to urge violence against Democrats he claimed were preventing the re-election of Donald Trump. When the posts appeared in news stories, his public account was removed, and he was forced to resign. While the Parler algorithm does not promote posts to keep users engaged, the company says it is serious about its commitment to free speech and does not block extremist content. Amy Peacock.
The fact that we don't block out the content from various extremists does not mean that our goal is to further all of those views, right? What we are planning to do is give the widest freedom possible so that people can have a full discussion.
That is not much different from the founding missions of Facebook and Twitter. But the major internet firms, criticized for keeping people engaged by suggesting content that is more extreme, have increasingly taken steps to curtail the spread of misinformation. And then came Parler. Michael Karanikolas is the Wikipedia fellow at the Yale School of Law.
It potentially suggests that if platforms do try and steer people away from these echo chambers, steer people away from what they want, that people will just migrate elsewhere, right? It's a reminder that as powerful as these platforms are, and as overwhelmingly popular as they are, it is not a monopoly.
It's too soon to know whether Parler will have lasting appeal. But for now, as the U.S. grapples with the results of the 2020 election, Parler has carved out a unique digital hangout. Matt Dibble for VOA News, San Francisco.
You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Tracy Carter, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Under its Rewards for Justice program, the United States is offering a reward of up to $3 million for information leading to the location or identification of Muhammad Khadir Musa Ramadan. Ramadan is a senior leader and a key propagandist for ISIS. Born in Jordan, Ramadan is also known as Abu Bakr al-Gharib. He is one of ISIS's longest-serving media officials and oversees the group's daily media operations, including the management of content from ISIS's dispersed global network of supporters. Ramadan has played a key role in ISIS's propaganda operations to radicalize, recruit, and incite individuals around the globe. He has overseen the planning, coordination, and production of numerous propaganda videos, publications, and online platforms that included brutal and cruel scenes of torture and mass execution of innocent civilians. The reward for Muhammad Khadir Ramadan is part of the United States' commitment to ensure the enduring defeat of ISIS in Iraq and Syria. Since its inception in 1984, the Rewards for Justice program has paid in excess of $150 million to more than 100 people who provided actionable information that helped bring terrorists to justice or prevented acts of international terrorism. If you have information on Muhammad Khadir Ramadan, contact the Rewards for Justice office via the website at www.rewardsforjustice.net, email info@rewardsforjustice.net, or mail Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20520-0303, USA. Individuals may also contact the regional security officer at the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate. All information will be kept strictly confidential.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.